The next case on the court's calendar is State v. Foster. We are ready for oral arguments. As the attorneys may note, our third colleague, Judge Halbrechts, is appearing remotely within Minnesota, but she is unexpectedly and unavoidably unable to be here in person. With that, we will hear from counsel for appellant. Would you introduce yourself for the record before beginning your argument?
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Jenna Yauch Erickson. I am an assistant state public defender, and I represent the appellant in this matter, Mr. Larry Foster. Mr. Foster has raised five issues for this court's consideration, and this morning I would like to begin by discussing the first. That is, that the district court violated Mr. Foster's constitutional rights, including his right to compulsory process, by prohibiting him from calling the alternative perpetrator, Reginald Jackson, to the witness stand.
What was the purpose for calling the alternative perpetrator, or the hypothetical alternative perpetrator?
Yes, Your Honor. The reason that the defense gave, and this is at page 800 of the transcript, was it was to allow the jurors to compare Mr. Jackson's body to the security video that's in evidence. There's actually two different videos in evidence that show about 45 people coming and going from Mr. Bradley's house on the day of the murder. Now, the defense argued one of those people, and they identify which one, was Mr. Jackson. The state does not agree. This is a contested fact. On appeal, respondent still maintains that there was no evidence connecting Mr. Jackson to this house.
So the defense didn't want to ask Mr. Jackson any questions?
I don't know that they would have asked him any questions. It was very clear he was going to invoke. I think perhaps they could have asked him his name, his date of birth. That's what happened in Gray, the Maryland case where they allowed the defendant to call the alternative perpetrator. They asked name, date of birth, and the alternative perpetrator witness stood in the courtroom. But what they wanted to do is give the jurors that physical ability to compare Mr. Jackson to the video to decide for themselves, was he there the day of the murder?
I appreciate the arguments that both sides have made about this issue and the suggestion that it's an issue of first impression, but the question I have is whether this is really an issue of first impression given this court's decision in State v. Carpenter. Are you familiar with the Carpenter case?
I don't believe so, Your Honor.
So in Carpenter, we wrote, the district court therefore concluded that the witness had invoked his privilege against self-incrimination and properly refused to order DH to take the stand to testify because DH wholly and unequivocally invoked his right against self-incrimination, and because the district court is not required to compel a witness to take the stand after proper invocation, we conclude that the district court did not abuse its discretion by refusing to order DH to take the stand.
I would have two responses, Your Honor.
Okay.
Not being familiar with the case, I can't know for sure, but if that case did not involve an alternative perpetrator witness, you should adopt a different rule for that circumstance. Also, this case is different because it wasn't simply, I guess, let me clarify my position. What I am not asking this court to hold is that the words, I refuse to testify because it would incriminate me, is evidence, or that the jury should draw any inference from that evidence. Not our position. Instead, on the unique facts of this case, Mr. Jackson's physical presence in the courtroom did have evidentiary value. The jury should have been allowed to view him, and the only way to do that is to call him as a witness.
Is it the only way to do that? I mean, that really is my question. I mean, putting someone on the witness stand for the sole purpose of saying, here's my name, here's my address, bye, you know, we're done with you, is unusual, mm-hmm. if not unheard of. Making argument based on that incident in closing, which is what I presume the purpose of calling the witness in this situation would have done, would also seem a challenge. And I don't know, I would have had to see like what the argument was to determine whether it was properly extracted from that limited interaction in court. But isn't there another way, or wasn't there another way to get to the evidentiary value of what your client was trying to achieve in the trial without putting the person on the witness stand?
I'm not sure there is, Your Honor. Certainly no one in this case came up with any alternatives. In a future case, perhaps it was recently suggested to me, you could make the person's body an exhibit. I don't know. I'm not a trial practitioner. I don't know that
but
that's
let
possible.
Let me ask you that, because I was a trial practitioner.
Sure.
And I'm going through the rules. And what authority? My recollection is the privilege against self-incrimination applies to testimony, applies to words. What authority is there in the criminal rules for a judge to order a third party to appear in court for the purpose of being observed by the jury, not for the purpose of providing any testimony? What rule says a judge can do that?
Sure, Your Honor. Again, two responses. One is, I think the closest corollary is the rule, and I don't know, I can perhaps find the number for you when I sit down before rebuttal. The rule that allows juries to do things like view scenes, mm-hmm. to leave the courtroom and go look at stuff.
But that's stuff.
Sure.
What authority is there to say to a third party,
mm-hmm.
you must appear in court for the purpose of being viewed by a jury?
So that's my second response, and that is the right to compulsory process. The bedrock cases on that right say you get to call witnesses, compel attendance, secure evidence, and you get to put it in front of a jury.
But that's a witness, that you get to bring a third party into the courtroom to give testimony unless they invoke their fifth. So you're citing rules about calling a witness, which is someone who's going to tell the jury something to support the proposition that you can bring in a person and just make him stand and, I guess, spin in front of the jury and then leave the courtroom.
Sure. So Gray has done that. There are a number of other, there are at least three circuits and four states across the United States that give the district court the discretion to make this call.
One of the points that you touched on, but we haven't talked about it, is it doesn't seem like your client wanted to call this person, the alternate perpetrator, as a witness, mm-hmm. but instead wanted to introduce him as an exhibit.
Well, and again,
that's what it seems, what the argument is.
So let me be clear about the record. They did ask the district court to allow them to call him, put him on the stand, have him invoke. It is very clear. They want Mr. Jackson to invoke on the stand.
Yes.
They posit to the district court, there may be non-incriminating questions that we can ask him. That may be just speaking his name and his date of birth. That may have been other questions. Part of what Herbert says about why you allow this is because folks can change their mind. When someone gets up on that witness stand, they may either think, well, that's not incriminating. I can answer that.
I understand all of that. But it seems like the argument you're making today is that the value of calling or bringing this person into the courtroom was for observation, which is typically what an exhibit is for, mm-hmm. not what a witness is for. So it does seem to me like now we have a different argument than that was presented in district court.
I would disagree, Your Honor. So the record, there are multiple arguments made in this record. It is pretty thoroughly litigated. And the defense offers numerous reasons that they would like to bring Mr. Jackson in. They are very clear, consistently throughout, they want him to invoke on the stand. They want the jury to see that invocation. If the district court rules against them, they ask for the instruction. They want the jury to know he invoked. He said, I don't want to testify because it would incriminate me. Right? So that is their position, that they never waver from that. When pressed, additionally, they explain there's some unique evidentiary value in this case because of the video, because the jury could compare his person.
So let's just talk about that unique evidentiary value.
Yes.
Let's separate the testimonial piece of it, I'm not going to testify,
mm-hmm.
from the I want the jury to observe him.
Mm-hmm.
Just in full transparency, I'm very interested in this, I want the jury to observe him, that evidentiary piece.
Sure.
Is that witness testimony or is that an exhibit?
I don't know that we know the answer to that question. I have not, in any of the cases that I've read, there are cases that say defendant gets to call alternative perpetrator to the stand to invoke and treats that as a witness and treats that as testimony.
Okay. We have a case here published, which is based on a Supreme Court case,
that says when it is crystal clear to the district court that someone's going to invoke, the district court should not put that person on the stand.
Only if a prosecutor is doing it. So no Minnesota court has ever addressed this question. And the reason that you should adopt a different rule here is because the government and individual criminal defendants are not similarly situated.
I understand that, but then the problem I have with that argument is we tell jurors, make no assumptions based on a witness's failure to appear or a witness's or a defendant's decision not to testify. We don't want jurors to make decision based on speculation as to why someone is not testifying. Yet you're asking us to ignore that principle and say, well, unless the defendant's calling somebody and they invoke, in which case it's okay to assume that they're guilty and that's why they're invoking.
Not at all, Your Honor. Again, that is not the rule I'm asking you to adopt. I do not believe and I do not think you should write an opinion that says a jury can infer something negative from an alternative perpetrator's invocation on the stand. The words have no evidentiary value.
But you were starting to argue that we should force the person to come into court and do the invocation in front of the jury. Well, what evidentiary value does that have?
I guess this isn't a full answer to your question, but part of my answer is why not? Their right to refuse to incriminate themselves is still intact. No one suggested Mr. Jackson should be forced.
Why not is because it invites the jury to speculate regarding why they are invoking the Fifth.
Which you can cure with a jury instruction, which other courts have done. You can instruct the jury that you cannot draw any inference from a person's invocation.
What's the point of showing the invocation to the jury? So we're going to bring the witness in, knowing he's going to invoke the Fifth, have him invoke the Fifth, and then tell the jury to ignore it?
Yes. Again, here, there was unique evidentiary value, and I would suggest to this court this focus on was there or was there not evidentiary value from the invocation is the wrong lens through which to view this question. A, there's no precedent that says you have to. I disagree firmly with respondent on this, and I'm happy to address it more. Instead, you're looking at constitutional rights and were they violated? The error is okay. Were they violated?
Okay, so then is there authority that a defendant has a constitutional right to bring a person in to the courtroom for the sole purpose of allowing the jury to make an observation of that purpose or of that person?
Is I don't
there
know,
any authority?
I don't know that there's anything that specific, Your Honor. And that's, again...
And I understand that that would be derived from the defendant's right to present a complete defense. And I'm just wondering if there's some authority that... or some case where a defendant has said, I can't present my complete defense without the jury laying eyes on this person.
Sure. So I would turn to the sort of language of the foundational cases about compulsory process, right? Because... they don't say you only get to bring in testimony. They say evidence. They say presence. They say attendance. That suggests the physical person has to be in the courtroom in front of the jury during the trial. That is what we would submit Mr. Foster was entitled to and what was violated. And Mr. Jackson's rights can be accommodated.
I'm looking at Rule 22 governing subpoenas in criminal cases. The court may issue for a subpoena for the attendance of witnesses and documents. Witnesses, documents. I mean, there is nothing that says the court can order a subpoena directing a person to come into the courtroom against their will to be observed by the jury so they can decide whether perhaps he is the perpetrator of the crime.
And again, I would say that is fundamental to Mr. Foster's right to compulsory process, due process, and a right to present a defense. And the U.S. Supreme Court has actually said, and this case is cited, I believe, in my reply brief, it's compulsory process is more than subpoena power. So the idea that all he gets is to call Mr. Jackson to the courthouse outside the presence of the jury, the U.S. Supreme Court has rejected that, said not enough. It is more than subpoena power. I'd actually like to go back to something from the...
What more is there than subpoena power? Are we going to arrest the third party and bring him into the courtroom in shackles against his will?
I don't think that was necessary in this case. I don't know that that is what the Constitution allows.
But I know I'm just curious about this. It's like, well, it's... You're entitled to more than subpoena power. What more is there than subpoena power?
Bringing him in front of the jury and making him take the witness stand.
And you would do that through a court order, a subpoena.
Right. So the district court here prohibited Mr. Foster from calling Mr. Jackson. He was under subpoena. He showed up. He was in the courthouse. They discussed this. And Judge Quam, in about a one-sentence ruling after full litigation, said only, this has no evidentiary value. You can't call him. That's not the law in the state of Minnesota. So this brings me back to the point I wanted to make.
And as to the physical comparison, there were photographs admitted at trial of Mr. Jackson?
Yes.
And why were those inadequate for that purpose?
They were from the head up only, and they are two-dimensional, not three-dimensional. The jury needed to compare his height, his weight, his stature, his movement to this person that they saw on a video, not a two-dimensional, two-dimensional but moving through space, to be able to determine whether that's the same person. They're like headshots, essentially. That doesn't allow the jury to compare him to a video. The point I wanted to make is, Your Honor, we talked about abuse of discretion. If this court adopts a discretionary rule, which you can, other states and circuits have it, the district court here abused its discretion because it applied the wrong law. It made an error of law. It is not the law in the state of Minnesota that an invocation never has evidentiary value. No one has said that. They've certainly not said it in this context. So even if you adopt that sort of rule, we would submit that the judge here abused his discretion and you should reverse. My time has expired. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, counsel. I'm Assistant Hennepin County Attorney Adam Petras, and I represent the respondent in this matter, the state of Minnesota. The state requested oral argument in this appeal because this court has the opportunity, at least I thought it had the opportunity, to announce a new rule of law on appellant's lead claim when they were just discussing. And I have to admit to this panel that the first I came across State v. Carpenter was when Judge Larkin had asked about that about 15 minutes ago.
Well, you can thank my law clerk because she came across it for all of us.
And just for opposing counsel's benefit, I believe it's a pin site, or I should say a citation 893 Northwest 2nd. 380. It's a 2017 precedential decision from this court. And I did read the paragraph, Judge Larkin, that you had read to Ms. Yock-Erickson before, and I believe that would control the issue in this case. Obviously, that was a precedential decision that existed at the time of this trial in August 2020. I don't believe it was caught by the trial practitioners. It was obviously also not caught by either Ms. Yock-Erickson or myself. And it does seem to be a logical extension of Morales, which is another way that this court could have addressed this issue in the absence of Carpenter. I am happy to entertain any specific questions.
I mean, it's no mystery that I'm now interested in this sort of distinction between calling the witness to testify versus calling the witness for some exhibit value. And you heard the representation that would be derived from the defendant's right to compulsory process. How do you respond to that?
I disagree. Taylor v. Illinois, which was a United States Supreme Court decision from 1988 that cited three times in appellant's reply brief, addresses the compulsory process clause. And this is what it says. The accused does not have an unfettered right to offer testimony that is incompetent, privileged, or otherwise admissible.
That's under testimony. We're not talking about testimony. I'm not talking about testimony. I don't think what Ms. Yock-Erickson is talking about.
I did hear argument, and sorry for not getting there quick enough. Judge Frisch, I'm not aware of any rule procedure going back to Rule 22 that Judge Larkin was just reading off, or any case anywhere, particularly in this state, that identifies, apart from testimony, the compulsory process allowing the display of a person being ordered into the courtroom to, as Judge Larkin said, spin around so that the jury could hear them.
And what if there's a showing by a defendant that there's some evidentiary value in having the jury be able to compare the three-dimensional live living person to whatever is on a video for purposes of determining the validity of an accepted alternative perpetrator defense? There's some relevance there, it seems to me.
Unless we're talking specifically about Rule 401, 402, 403 of the Rules of Evidence, I'm not aware of any type of legal mechanism, rule of evidence, that would allow the presentation of a person. I understand going to a scene. I understand what Rule 22 and the criminal rules of procedure says about subpoena power. I understand the different types of testimony. I'm not aware of any authority that exists to order that.
I mean, the admissibility piece of it, I think, could be solved through a variety of different ways. You have somebody who's admitting the, you know, whoever the witness is that's getting the video in, and then on cross-examination, you can compare it to somebody who's sitting in the gallery. That happens from time to time. You could have him cut on the stand and say, my name is X, and then get him off. That's what was suggested just a few moments ago.
Right, right. I don't think that would serve what his name is ever or any evidentiary value. I think if you read this exhaustive trial transcript, it's pretty clear that Reginald Jackson has talked about quite a lot, and his name is pretty certain to everyone involved in the case. Going to the photos that I cited in my brief, I think it's Exhibit 721 and 722. It's in a footnote. I forget which page exactly, as well as the different references to what Mr. Jackson looked like. One of those photos was taken by the defense investigator. So the claim that, you know, it was only a headshot, that was a strategic decision, or it was an ineffective assistance of counsel situation that has not been raised in this court for when they had the opportunity to take a photo of Mr. Jackson. When he was at the courthouse in response to a subpoena, they chose just to take one of his head and then make the argument later that because they only have that limited photo, they can't adequately compare it to the surveillance video.
I'm reading through these rules because this is a fascinating discussion, but I'm now looking at Rule 901 sub 2 having to do with discretionary disclosure by court order upon request of defendant. There is nothing in this rule suggesting that the court could order somebody to come into court as a discovery mechanism. And, I mean, even other relevant material the rule speaks to on defendant's motion. Trial court at any time before trial may, in its discretion, require the prosecutor to disclose, permit relevant material information not subject to disclosure. I mean, there's nothing here that supports this concept of bringing a third party into the courtroom as an exhibit by the defense. And I should state, because I was the one to bring up State v. Carpenter, that is a case where the defendant wanted to call his accomplice to the stand at his trial, and the accomplice said, not doing it, I've pleaded guilty, but my appeal's still pending, I'm taking the Fifth, and this court said, you can't call him. So this is a case by a defendant. It seems right on point.
It does. I believe Ms. Jock-Erickson was referring before to Mitchell and Morales when talking about there was a lack. You can ask her about that when she gets back up here in rebuttal.
And I just meant for her benefit. And
right.
My other colleagues who might not be aware of
it. I did read the case quickly during the previous argument, and I did deduce that aspect of it. I just want to make a quick point about Judge Qualm's ruling here. If this court is going to announce something new along the lines of what Judge Frisch and I were just talking about in terms of what could be presented in a jury trial, I would just ask that it be made prospective and that given the law, Carpenter, perhaps unbeknownst to Judge Qualm at the time, or as Morales, Mitchell, and all of the other jurisdiction case law that Ms. Jock-Erickson and I discuss extensively in our briefs, that's what was provided to Judge Qualm. And it wasn't just a single sentence ruling. He heard the argument, he told the parties how he was inclined to rule, gave them the opportunity to brief it over the weekend. Both parties filed briefs, this was from a Friday to a Monday, and then he readdressed it a second time, saying that, you know, as I made, I think, fairly clear in my brief, the lack of any evidentiary value to what he understood the parties to be asking to happen is why he didn't think that the invocation need to be made in front of the jury.
Could you address the prosecutorial misconduct argument, whether there were some errors, perhaps, or some misconduct, and whether it was prejudicial?
I don't believe there were any errors, and I don't believe it was prejudicial. I can specifically talk about the three instances that were during the cross-examination of Mr. Foster, or I can focus on the nine alleged instances during the closing argument.
I am a little bit bothered by, well, if it were you or I, and we had an alternative perpetrator, you and I would have brought that to the police right away. It seemed across the line.
I think the way that I tried to characterize in my brief is that's unartful. No, I would, if I was advising a trial trial prosecutor if I was doing it myself in a perfect world, which closing arguments, as you're well aware, Judge Larkin, are not always perfect. That's not the way to say it. No. But at the same time...
One of the many lies he told in his testimony, that's okay?
I mean, I believe that it was very similar to how Mr. Foster's trial prosecutor was talking about the lies that various state witnesses said. It's inappropriate.
It's different for a prosecutor, as you know.
I understand the Minister of Justice and the case law that I believe you're referring to, Judge Frisch. But my point is that the trial prosecutor was not calling Mr. Foster a habitual liar. He was not saying that.
Any lies that the defendant told.
I believe there were inaccuracies between his testimony and what the physical and forensic evidence did and showed. And I believe that is what he was saying. And maybe lies is a bit of a more colorful word, but I think he was talking about the contrast between what the physical evidence showed and the forensic science showed and the claims that were being made from the witness stand.
Perhaps it would be good to address the prejudice, whether or not any of those statements resulted in prejudice to the defense. Because I don't think, I can't speak for my colleagues, I don't take those statements lightly. You can only say it was inartful for so long. At some point, you have to stop.
I will address the prejudice with my time remaining. But I do want to respond to the specific instance that you raised, Judge Larkin, which was that you or I mean, he was trying to talk about a hypothetical, which the trial prosecutor was. And if he had replaced the words you or I with a person and talked a little bit more in the abstract, I think it would have been a very permissible comment. But I do take what I'm sensing from this court, which is specific to that instance, that the slip, if you will, or going into a more colloquial language could have become closer to what I would deem prosecutorial error than not error.
I'd like to hear about prejudice on two points.
Yes.
One, as to the alleged Brady violation, not disclosing Mr. Jackson's prior bad acts, and two, the statements made in closing arguments. And why don't you start with the statements made in closing arguments since we just discussed those.
Understood. This was a very lengthy trial, an extremely lengthy closing argument, I believe, in terms of transcript pages, both the prosecutors and defense counsels numbered like about 110 pages. There were multiple instances that had been identified by appellant, but at the same time, were not dominating the closing argument by any imagination. I mean, I realize opposing counsel takes issue with this, but the evidence in this case was immense. I understand Mr. Foster got up on the stand and told a version of events that tried to take into account the surveillance video, the cell phone records, the forensic evidence, whether it be fingerprinting or blood evidence, where all the different objects were and why his DNA was on so many of those objects. And I think, to put it lightly, it was a very far-fetched story. And I think that is what the defense had to go on at that time. So in terms of the individual, isolated comments that the trial prosecutor made throughout the course of his lengthy closing argument, I don't think those tipped the scales or at a reasonable probability of impacting the verdict, given the 14 days of trial, 8.5 of, I believe, which were strictly evidence, as well as, the version of events that the defense had to go on.
Just because we do have limited time, I'll cut right to the chase. I, as somebody who's tried cases and presided over cases, I could very easily imagine that this might have gone a different way if the jury had heard this version of the events that takes into account all of this, which you call far-fetched, and then heard, well, Mr. Jackson has a history of dealing drugs, violence.
Which they did hear. There was evidence presented at trial about Mr. Jackson being a drug dealer. Mr. Foster testified to that. That was never something disputed by the state.
Okay. But it's coming from Mr. Foster, who was very self-interested. What if?
I believe there are other witnesses that talked about Mr. Jackson also using and dealing drugs from Mr. Bradley's home, the deceased in this case.
And so what other person Which other person testified to that?
In my brief, I outlined each of the witnesses. I don't have that at the top of my head. I am sorry. I know that the defense called I don't want to say excessive by any means, but a higher than typical number of witnesses for the defense. This was a very full-throated defense presentation in the trial court.
I believe the district court reasoned that on the Brady violation, the materiality prong wasn't satisfied because there wasn't any prejudice because Mr. Jackson's prior bad acts were inadmissible under 404B, so they, you know, the lack of that evidence couldn't be prejudicial when that evidence couldn't have been offered in the first place. Could you address that? And I'll ask Mr. Foster's counsel to do the same.
Judge Quam wrote a thorough 19-page post-conviction order that focused on that materiality prong. I mean, as opposed to like a separate prejudice analysis, prejudice is kind of baked into the materiality prong of a Brady claim. And I agree with the individual incidents that were extracted from those 125 pages of police reports that have been highlighted in the briefing. None of them would have been admissible as reverse Spiegel. Maybe if there was a different underlying crime, maybe if it was a domestic assault, maybe if it was a domestic assault murder, but not given the facts as they came to be in this case involving Mr. Bradley, involving Mr. Foster, and the way in which he died, and also the way that the defense theory was for Mr. Jackson's involvement. I have a few seconds left. I'm happy to attempt to answer any further questions.
Sandy, thank you for your arguments.
Just respectfully ask this court to affirm.
I've got a lot to cover. I think I'll start with prejudice. The best evidence that this evidence was not so overwhelming is that the jury deliberated for about 2.5 days. If the evidence was overwhelming, they would have come back a lot quicker. Also, the litany of evidence the state keeps referring to, the physical, the forensics, or surveillance, is perfectly explained by Mr. Foster's testimony. None of this contradicts Mr. Foster's testimony. If this was a case where the defense was, I wasn't there, yeah, the evidence is damning. He says he was there. He says he touched things. He says he left his DNA because he was cut and bleeding everywhere. In fact, the state's evidence does not explain a whole bunch of things. Like if he had just, Mr. Foster had just brutally murdered someone and he knows he's deceased based on the murder, why did he run around the backyard trying to figure out where to hide? Why did he take a weapon with him and choose the most difficult way to get out of that backyard? Because he was hiding, not because he was escaping a murder. The prejudice here, and this goes to the cumulative error, is that all of these things go together. Every single one undermined his defense, and there is a strong possibility that the verdict would have been different if the jury had heard these things.
Heard what?
The reverse Spiegel was admissible.
Why was it admissible?
This court's case law is very clear. It is time, place, or manner. It is a disjunctive test, and neither respondent nor the district court has ever explained why the similarity in time and the similarity in place aren't enough. All of this court's Spiegel case law says if they're in the same county, they're enough. These are all a mile.
Were the priors similar?
So my point is they don't have to be. Time or place is enough. If we're talking about MO, it's because they showed that Mr. Jackson is a person.
How do you have time and place?
Because they're all in Hennepin County, which is what this court looks for, and they all happen within a. This court typically will affirm the admission of Spiegel evidence when they happen within about 15 or 16 years.
Okay, so you're saying our case law says Spiegel comes in as long as the offense happened in the same county as the charged
yes.
offense within 15 years?
Yes.
Well, I just don't agree with that.
Okay, well, I can refer you to those cases cited in my brief.
I think there is probably more to the analysis than simply a rule that any prior bad act that happened in the same county as the charged offense within the past 15 years comes
in. If we're talking about similarity, right, so it's a three-pronged disjunctive test. It's always been an or. You only need one. You don't need
all
three.
What's the similarity between a prior allegation of domestic abuse against a domestic partner and what occurred in this case?
Sure. So if we're talking specifically about the abuse allegations, They're multiple, and they demonstrate that Mr. Jackson is a person who feels possessive of other people's residences and lashes out physically and violently when that authority is threatened. He doesn't just...
Sounds like the very reason we don't allow this evidence. He did it before, so he did it again.
Nope, that's not what I'm saying. It shows his MO. His MO is that he's a person who feels he has a proprietary interest over others' residences. This is shown by the fact that he's not just beating up this woman. He's breaking in. He's refusing to leave when she asks him to leave. He's damaging her property while he's there. This is the same as him feeling entitled to use Mr. Bradley's home to deal drugs out of. Remember, we have evidence in the record from a witness who says they argued. These two, the victim and Mr. Jackson, argued close in time to the murder. They argued about money. They argued about the fact that he's using his home to sell drugs. There's other testimony that he felt very at home there, and he felt like he could sort of command the place. The witness's testimony was something like he was running the place. He acted like he was running the place. That's exactly the same as the Spriegel evidence. There's also the drug dealing, which I want to be clear about this. Mr. Foster's testimony is the only evidence in the record because the state objected to the introduction of more testimony about drug dealing, and the district court granted affirmed that objection. It didn't come in. So for the state to now say, we all agreed he was a drug dealer, they didn't. They objected to it, and they wanted it kept out, and it was kept out. There were two pieces of testimony that the defense offered about drug dealing, objection sustained. The defense investigator and one of the eyewitnesses who said she had seen him at Bloomington and Lake selling drugs. So the drug dealing evidence also should have come in as reverse Spriegel because it corroborates Mr. Foster's testimony. Also, the fact that he is physically capable and willing of specifically jumping over a fence to flee a crime and to flee law enforcement, precisely what the defense theory was here. All of that should have come in, and that changes the outcome because we know this jury already deliberated long and hard. Because the evidence is not that strong when you view it in light of Mr. Foster's testimony.
What about the absence of physical evidence connecting Mr. Jackson to the crime scene? Was there any physical evidence that he had been there?
Depends on what you consider physical evidence. You have the phone records that show him there that day. You have the testimony of multiple witnesses, including a witness who puts him there close in time. I think it's the day before, but it's close in time.
How does the jury get past, here is this horrific crime scene, blood everywhere, literally everywhere.
Yes.
And Jackson's DNA isn't there, Jackson's fingerprints aren't there, Jackson's blood's not there. How does he get out of that crime scene without leaving any biological evidence?
I guess I'll try and quickly focus on two things, Your Honor. One is that there's no allegation that he was ever bleeding. So you have two people who were bleeding everywhere. One who wasn't. Most of what they tested, the vast majority of the forensic evidence that was tested by the BCA was blood swabs. They are not going to find Mr. Jackson there because he was not bleeding. And just one example for this court of the sort of troubling investigation and the lack of evidence here. The state believes that this knife that was found outside of the house was one of the murder weapons. They swab it for blood. They submit those swabs. I believe it's the victim, Mr. Foster's blood is found on the knife. They never submit the touch swabs. The one thing that could perhaps conclusively establish that Mr. Jackson was not the one to wield the knife, the fact that he would have had to hold the knife, and unless he was gloved, he probably would have left DNA, never tested, never submitted to the BCA. Submitted? What I can tell you is, the vast majority of what they tried to exclude him from was blood swabs. There were maybe one or two that they tried to exclude him from that were touch. So again, if he's not bleeding, of course he's not there. The BCA took samples where there were only one or two profiles identified. They've already figured out who those profiles are, and they say, look, Mr. Jackson isn't one of those profiles. Of course he's not. All that shows is that he's not Larry Foster and he's not Daniel Bradley.
I have some additional questions.
Absolutely.
I wanted to let you tail end that reverse Spriegel evidence. I have a question about the evidentiary value of the body.
Yes.
Let's assume, for purposes of argument, that there is some evidentiary value associated with the alternative perpetrator's body. Given that your client was able to submit evidence of, or at least a photograph or photographs of the alternate perpetrator and had the opportunity to present additional photographs if the investigator would have taken pictures of the full body as opposed to just the headshot, what is the harm beyond a reasonable doubt in excluding the body from being brought into the courtroom?
Sure. This sort of piggybacks on what I've already said, but viewing someone in three dimensions to compare to a video of movement is very different than comparing to a still photo. So I'm not going to be able to say more than this, but the idea of whether or not they could photograph Jackson was contested and litigated. I don't want to say anything that's incorrect, but I'm not sure that they would have been allowed to take more photos or different photos. All I can tell you right now, because this record is immense, is that it was litigated, sort of the parameters of that. And if this court, of course, wished, we could submit some sort of supplemental briefing or a supplemental authority just to identify the place in the record where that occurred.
And the inadequacy of the photo is that it was insufficient to enable the jury to make a fair comparison with the video?
Absolutely. They can't tell how tall he is. They can't tell whether he's a muscular man. Does he have a pot belly? What do his hands look like? How does he move? This video is video, right? It shows people coming and going from this house and walking. They wouldn't have been able to see him move in a picture. It's shoulders up. That's all they get of Mr. Jackson.
So the evidence. So it's not just bringing the person on the stand or bringing this person in for evidentiary value. It's bringing the person in and doing some performative act so that they can compare to the video. Is that?
I mean, they didn't ask for anything specifically like, can we have him walk around? Presumably, the act of entering the courtroom and walking to the witness stand does that. I don't want to put words in anyone's mouth. I believe that's part of what they wanted. That's part of why they said, we want to call him to the witness stand, because it involves walking, getting in the stand, saying whatever he's going to say, and walking out. This is no different.
This argued below, it seems to me that my recollection is the real push was, you've got to bring him in here and make him take the fifth in front of the jury. And we might come up with some questions to ask him that would not incriminate him, but you need to have him take the fifth in front of the jury. Are the arguments that you're making, were those made to the district court?
Absolutely. Page 800 of the transcript is where they say, we want him to come in so the jury can compare him to the video. I would ask Your Honor's permission to give you about 2 seconds on Carpenter, because I do think it's significant. Carpenter does not resolve this case for 2 reasons. First, it asked a different question. I've read it really quickly. What the defendant argued in Carpenter was the district court abused its discretion. Number one, argued abuse of discretion, because the district court's evaluation of whether or not the invocation was valid was inadequate. That's simply not the issue here. Second, I do not see from Carpenter that defendant put his compulsory process rights at issue, said, you violated my compulsory process rights. That also makes this different. We've made a different argument. I apologize that we did not find that authority for this court, but it is not, sure, it's on point. It does not resolve the case. Thank you very much. I appreciate your time.
Thank you. That concludes the arguments. We appreciate the briefing. We know it's a big case, a lot of issues, a lot of paper. We appreciate your work and helping us come to the right decision. You'll have that decision within 90 days. That concludes our oral calendar this morning.
All rise.